Hello and welcome to the podcast on negotiation. And today, a very special guest, Beth Yoshida Fisher, who is the director of the program on conflict management at Columbia School of Professional Services. Did I get it right, Beth?
Almost. School of Professional Studies, it's negotiation and conflict resolution.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us, Beth.
Thanks, Remy.
And we will discuss a very important topic today, and that is a woman's guide on negotiation. Which, if you guys are interested, make sure you get Beth's new book. Well, it's maybe not a brand new book. It came out, I think, last year. It's called New Story, New Power: A Woman's Guide to Negotiation. And we'll talk about a lot of things, including how, what was the inspiration for the book, what you guys will be able to find in there, and a couple of general remarks on how women negotiate, what they need to become better negotiators. Right, so let's get going. I think one of the first chapters, Beth, starts with a title, "Why This Book Now?" So let me throw back this question, throw back at you, and ask you what inspired you to write a new story, New Power.
Great, thanks so much for having me and for having this good conversation, which I'm anticipating. So I have been in the field of negotiation for quite a while, and I've been focusing on women in negotiation. And when you look at the research and the practice and the commentary, there are a lot of contradictory comments about it, and research shows women have a more challenging time. Some say, no, they don't have a more challenging time. They have certain skills and assets that also enhance their negotiation. So I figured, okay, let me do some of my own research on top of that to see what I'm finding. So I did some research. I interviewed more than 100 women, and I had the same pattern of contradictory outcomes from that. And I said, okay, well, I'm not really a researcher per se. I'm really more of a scholar practitioner. So my focus is really more on learning from research and learning from theory, but really about how can I use this in the practice. So I figured, since I tend to be an educator and I do workshops and training and so on, I figured, let me put what I've learned from my own research and from all the other wonderful people who've done research on this topic into something that I could communicate to others so they can find it useful. Because my main theme on top of everything was it has to be practical. It has to be where people can pick up the book and immediately begin to use it. And that was the MO in putting the book together. So I figured, okay, I have some information here, let me share it. Now, a parallel process that happened to me, which I talk about in the book, but it happened to me as well, is the whole idea of narrative and the stories we tell. So one of the things I get at is self-awareness and how aware are we of our strengths and how we're using them and what do we tell ourselves about who we how we negotiate and who we are. So as I'm writing this book, I'm having that same, who do you think you are writing this book? When did you become an expert about women and negotiation? And then I sort of had this meta perspective on myself going, oh my God, I'm doing the same thing that I'm writing about other women do. And then I laughed at myself. And then I said, well, it's not only your opinion, you've done the research, you're including other people's research, you've done interviews, you're including other people's perspectives. So you have something to say to share with others based on all of this information that you've collected.
Amazing. Okay, so that's sort of your perspective, adding value to the community, writing a book which is practical, which can be used as an inspiration for, let's say, for to become better negotiators. Yes, for women to become better negotiators. but what is so unique about your book? What is the connection between the narrative? That's how it starts. New story, new power, and new narrative that leads to new power. Right? Why is this narrative needed? What's wrong with the old one?
Well, nothing's completely wrong with the old one because it brought everybody to where they are today. It's if you want to move forward in a more constructive, healthier way, you have to examine the multiple narratives that you carry, because all through our lives, we collect different stories from our experiences, from people around us. And all of these stories sometimes work together and sometimes they compete with each other in our own minds, conscious or not, about who we are and how we perform. So if you want to improve your performance, enhance what you're already doing well, then here are some tips on how to do that. And one way is to maybe tweak some of the stories to grow the ones that work well and to diminish the ones that don't, or I like to think rewrite them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing this. And Beth, what are the challenges, yes, that women typically face where this new narrative becomes helpful for them or could become helpful for them? Can they be generalized and put into, I don't know, archetypical buckets? It's for 1, 2, 3, or are they so diverse that it's impossible to categorize them?
No, there are definitely patterns. And the patterns are that we collect a lot of our stories from the world around us. So in the world around us, our families, our schools, our communities, one of their main purposes is to socialize young children into the world, to make them constructive contributing citizens, which means also that we have gendered stories and gendered patterns of behavior that we teach to young children. So when women, like young girls, are taught to be nice, when children are taught to be seen and not heard, all of these messages that we've received over the years, they live inside of our minds. So when we go to act and we go to negotiate on our behalves, we know that we have to be nice to young women. So that means if I am negotiating with somebody who's pushing back and not giving me what I want, I have this challenge in myself to say, okay, do I continue to be assertive or am I being nasty about it? Am I being aggressive? Do I need to pull back because I want to be liked? I want to be nice. So all of that goes on. And I'm not saying that we should throw everything away and just be super aggressive in the workplace. Not at all. We have to build relationships. We have to interact with people on a regular basis. So you want to build good relationships. But those stories, we need to really examine. Where did they come from? Why were they created? And boys and girls don't get the same stories. You know, sometimes in today's world, we say in the U.S. anyway, you know, everybody gets a trophy. Everybody gets a trophy. Like you get a trophy just for showing up and trying, which is not a bad thing, because part of what I'm saying in the rewriting of our scripts is that we should commend ourselves for the effort of trying something different. Even if it doesn't give us the outcomes that we want, we should commend ourselves and appreciate that we even tried.
Right. So those stories typically are context-based, right? I mean, that's the following chapter, that's the next chapter in your book. You're saying, well, it's not universal. You cannot say always be, you know, assertive, right? Or always be like this. It's, I think the message, as far as if I understood it correctly of the book, is, well, you need to rewrite the stories, but you have to make them context-specific. Yeah? And what are the typical contexts that are relevant to women, and how can they rewrite their stories to become better negotiators in the context they find themselves in?
Yeah. So when I first set out to write the book, I was going to make it workplace oriented, business oriented. And then when I was speaking to different women, then I noticed they said, well, do I have to tell a story about the workplace, or can I tell a story about my negotiations with my family or my personal life? I said, sure, you can do that. And then people said, you know, Beth, you should include other situations, not just the workplace, because we negotiate all over the place. And I'm like, oh, you know, that's right. It makes sense. So then I started looking at different contexts. So when you're in the workplace, you have different types of relationships than you do in your family, than you do when you go to your dry cleaners, than you do when you're in a romantic relationship. So because of the nature of the relationships, then the nature of the way you show up and the way you perform in your negotiation matters as well. You're going to have a different kind of understanding of professional in the workplace that you don't bring to your family. When you're at the dinner table or you're negotiating where to eat dinner, it's not the same as negotiating with your manager about your work assignments. So those contexts influence how we show up and then the kinds of narratives that we bring. Although some narratives do stay with us in all contexts.
Yes, that makes sense. The question I was wondering while I was reading your book is, why is it singular? Why is a story singular? You know, once I got to the context, the chapter on different contexts, I thought, is it possible to rewrite a consistent singular story? Or are we talking about a show, a Netflix show, which consists of different episodes, which are then sort of tackle different contexts? How do you see it? Is it more... let's say this rewiring or rewriting the story, is it more writing a book which has, you know, a beginning and an ending and something in between that connects them together? Or is it more like filming a Netflix show which has a main theme, but where, you know, episodes can be looser or more loosely connected with each other? How would you see this?
Interesting. I think it could be the change of one word. You can have one word that shifts, and the power of words. When we were younger, we were taught, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me. And I'm like, no, that's not true. Words are very harmful. So one little word, you know, can totally shift the whole perspective. So I think about a crystal or a kaleidoscope. You know, if you shift, like to turn the kaleidoscope and you shift it just a little bit, all the colored particles change into a whole new pattern. That's right. The kind of essence. You do one little shift, you know, in New York, where I'm from, you can take subways. Well, there's the beginning of a subway and the end of a subway train, right? And sometimes they have two separate exits. If you're in the habit of always exiting from the front of the train, but one day you're rushing and you end up on the back of the train, and then you go out the back exit, you could be just around the corner, but it's like, whoa, it's a whole other perspective on the world. You're like, where am I? Until then you turn the corner and you see you're only around the corner. So one word can totally shift the perspective. It doesn't have to be a whole book. The idea is that we're already doing things well to be where we are, to even be considering how to finesse and how to sort of manage our narrative. So that's why it could be just tweaking, but a series of tweaking. And you ask me why one story and not stories. I'm like, I don't even know. But the idea is that the general story and then the little nuances perhaps in between.
Yeah, makes sense. So what are the Beth, what are the key lessons? So now we talked about the story, the context, right? Let's talk about recommendations and lessons that you wanted to emphasize in the book, which are important also in your teaching and also in your practice as a negotiator. What are the key? Let's narrow it down to top three. Yes, top three recommendations for women out there, how they could rewrite their stories, make them context dependent, and become better negotiators in those contexts.
All right, so three. So I'll put
maybe five or four, whatever.
So I think the first thing that is primary in everything that I do in the program also that I run and all that is self-awareness. We have to really understand who we are, and that means who we are in relationship to many different types of people in many different types of contexts, and to continue to develop that awareness. Every day is a new day, and I use an image of a spiral for myself when I think about it. You may go back and revisit a topic with the same person, but it's not the same exactly as it was when you initially had that conversation, because you're not exactly the same. You've had different kinds of experiences. Even if it's the next day, you've had a chance to reflect. So you continuously work in a spiral. And I like to think you're working upwards and not downwards. So self-awareness. And the self-awareness means there's always an opportunity to learn about who you are and how you show up. So because we have many different personas from many different experiences that we've had, depending on the topic and who we're interacting with, depends upon which aspect of our persona shows up. So sometimes I'm not as conscious that I'm a woman. Of course, I'm always a woman, but I'm not as conscious of it. I'm more conscious of other things. Maybe I'm conscious of being a member of a club, or maybe I'm conscious of being an educator. But then other contexts, it's very, very clear to me that I'm a woman, because maybe I'm in a group of all men. I realize, okay, I'm a woman in this group. So that part of my persona may come forward. So always a chance to learn. So self-awareness is absolutely critical. And it's life work. It's forever. You always have a chance to learn something new. I guess the second category would be to break down the components of a negotiation to pre, process, and post. So in the pre-negotiation part, you really have to prepare. And I like to say that winging it is not a strategy. Winging it, yeah, I know enough about this. I'll go in there and see what happens. Well, you can do that, but you're not going to be as ready to deal with something that you're not anticipating. You'll be like a deer in the headlights and you're not really prepared for that. So you really need to spend equal amount of times in the preparation phase. And in the book, in section three, I believe it is, there are lots of different tools that I introduce to use to help you prepare. Each negotiation may call for a different tool or framework to use. during the course of the negotiation, you really depend on your preparation as a starting point. And then you need to be very present in the negotiation to figure out, is what I planned actually happening, or is there different information coming at me that I need to process quickly? But having that foundation from the preparation helps you feel secure and confident that you can handle whatever comes your way during the negotiation, including managing emotions. In the preparation, you're probably not feeling the emotions the way you might be triggered during the course of a negotiation. So in the preparation, you're also planning, how do I manage my emotions if something goes awry in the negotiation? And then really important is the post-negotiation part. And I see sometimes negotiations fail because people don't follow up. You've agreed to so many different kinds of things. You've touched on so many different topics in the negotiation. You want to make sure you and the other party are on the same page. So a summary, maybe some kind of action plan that you follow up with afterwards, so everybody knows what their course of action is going to be after the negotiation to carry out what you agreed to in the negotiation. And I guess the third part would be just to continue learning about different dynamics that you might find challenging. Maybe you find power dynamics challenging. Maybe you find different cultural orientations challenging. Maybe it's emotions and learning more about that. So learning about that and then bringing that into your negotiations will help you become, I think, a more sophisticated negotiator. So self-awareness, the parts, and then continuous learning.
That sounds like a closed loop. That sounds like a closed loop, right? I mean, it starts with self-awareness. Self-awareness leads to identification of potential improvements, which is, and then it feeds it back to through practice to being self-awareness again about how how well we are doing afterwards. So this is probably, let me blend in a message that we got from Theo, probably one of your students, because it looks
not a student but a colleague. Yes,
a colleague, right? Yes, excellent point. So to those of you guys who are listening to us and not seeing this this comment, excellent points. You are a champion, Beth Yoshida Fisher. Negotiation skills need to be learned, practiced, and developed. Thank you for leading the way for us. Yes, but still, regardless of...
Theo has always been a great champion. She's always a great cheerleader. So thank you.
Yes. There are still a lot of challenges that women are facing in their in the workplace and beyond. And let's talk about those for a while, for a second. Yes. for many... many decades, there was this dominant paradigm that women, let's say, do not perform as well in negotiation context. But this research was really flawed. It was conducted in a highly distributive and hard bargaining context, and so on and so on. Now we're a little bit understood that it's not the case. Yes, women are just as good, and in some instances they are better, and their performance is highly contextual, right? Which means that it gets better when certain certain aspects are not present. But let's talk about men-dominated domains. Yeah? So such as, let's say, automotives, or I don't know, whatever, whatever else. Automotive comes to my mind as first. I don't know why. Are women disadvantaged in those contexts if they decide to go into them? Or what can they do to be more successful in men-dominated environments? Do you have any recommendations for the ladies out there?
Yeah. So in my research, I spoke with women who are from male-dominated professions, mostly the sectors of what we call the STEM professions, right? So science, technology, and all of that. Mm-hmm. So a couple of things about that. So, you know, the onus should not be on the woman herself to make sure she can function in a different world. It needs to be relational. This is what I believe. So it's not just the men sit there and do what they do and the women have to adapt to the man's world. No, I think it's where the system itself has to change and everybody needs to adapt. If you go towards some kind of meta goal of getting along, better productivity for all, better outcomes, better quality of life in the workplace and so on. So it's not only on the women. And this has been a complaint sometimes when women say, don't only tell women they need to get better at something because it's not only dependent on the women. And I support that. I think everybody needs to get better at whatever they're doing. So that's one thing. And then the system. Now, when I've talked to some really experienced women, meaning they've been in STEM professions for more than 25, 30 years, and they've been successful, right? They've risen up the ranks and all that. There were a couple of things they told me. So they said, okay, if you're working with people, and it would be men in this case where they worked with, who have a very scientific kind of a mind and scientific way of thinking, like engineers, for example, and so on, then you can't express yourselves emotionally with a lot of feelings initially, because it'll just turn them off, right? So then you lose your audience. So what you're trying to do, which I love the idea of meeting people where they are, and then you bring them where you'd like them to be. So you have to meet people where they are in order to even be heard, in order to be acknowledged and recognized. So if you are somebody who really is very data, evidence-based driven and doesn't want to hear about how I feel about things, I'm not going to talk about how I feel. I'm going to be very evidence-based, data-driven in what I'm saying. Then I gain your respect, I gain the relationship, and eventually I can show a little bit more of the feeling side if I feel it will enhance what we're doing in the workplace, if I feel it will enhance the negotiation. So meeting people where they are means you have to know yourself and know what's the stretch. It's not being inauthentic. You're still who you are and you're still bringing it, because we have multiple personas there. Then you're just stretching a little bit to one of your strengths rather than another, because it's relational. So I also think that systemically, you know, we have people who want to see themselves reflected in the people that they're mentoring, in the people who are their proteges, and the people that they're hiring. So for male-dominated industries, it was hard to hire women because they didn't see themselves in the women. But slowly but surely, we have women sort of entering and advancing in the fields. It's still not on par. It's still not equal representation. But it's getting better over the years. But I remember, I think it was about 2 years ago, I did some research for a presentation. It was really sad to see that we haven't advanced as much as we think we have. That in so many, I'm just picturing the chart in my head that I had in my slides, that it was so many professions, it was still hovering in the 20, 30% representation, not on the 50% mark. And that had been that way for quite a while, in spite of all the efforts to move forward. For example, there are a lot of efforts in girls in STEM, helping girls code, all of those kinds of things. So I think eventually we will see it, and maybe it's generational, and that once you have more senior people advancing, they will bring others up with them to follow them.
And hopefully that will change also the system itself, right? Because as you correctly said, I think negotiation performance of women is context-based, right? So if there is a high gender bias in a particular organization, it lowers the performance. Yes, and that's a paradox to a certain extent. So because what it means is that, well, it's not only because of women's skill or negotiation skill, women's negotiation skills, because of how organizations are built. So you're absolutely correct, and I share this belief to make our world better, to make our organization more performant, not only we need women, we need to upskill men and women in their in what they can do in terms of their negotiation, but we also need to change the system. Yes, eliminate the bias. Yeah? So Beth, let's talk about the bias. I'm sure you've interviewees must have mentioned it, because it's I see it left and right. Many organizations have it, although some of them seem to be dedicated to fighting it, especially in the workplace. But what is your impression in terms of the state where we are at today? Yes, have we improved? And if yes, by how much? And if an individual, a woman, finds herself in an organization that is not only male-dominated, but also burdened with gender bias, what shall she do?
Yeah, so I think a lot of times the bias is implicit. I mean, in some cases, it is more overt. The person who is experiencing the bias against them always notices the bias, regardless if it's gender, race, whatever it is, religion. It's the person from the dominant group who may not notice it, right? But it sometimes can be very subtle, but you feel it. It's an experience that is hard to feel. It's like not tangible necessarily, but it is an intangible feeling that people experience. You may be left out of a group. You may not be copied on an email. You may not be considered for a certain promotion just because of that. So I think that it goes back to the self-awareness part, that you need to understand that every time you have a reaction to something, you have to say like, okay, what's that reaction about? And why am I feeling the way I do? And why am I thinking the way I do? And so on. So for me, many years ago, I lived in Japan for a very long time. And I was a strong, independent New York woman going to Japan, which had a very different, and still does, very different cultural orientation. And people say to me, why are you going to Japan? You know, women are not liberated there and so on. And I'm thinking, well, they're not liberated all over the United States either. So it doesn't matter. So for me, that strong cultural difference really helped me see cultural differences a lot more. And I think about bias also as cultural differences, because gender can be considered culture too. So then, because it was so blatant, the differences, and I'm not saying better or worse, just different, then I also realized that even as a woman, I was less discriminated against sometimes than a fellow Japanese woman in the Japanese workplace, which was interesting too, because I was outside of the norm. I was a foreigner. I was a gaijin in that case. But as an American, I was also treated differently than somebody from Southeast Asia, another woman. So there were all different ways of noticing what it was. When I came back to the US, I decided to take a closer look at gender and diversity in the US context, because it was so blatant to me there. I said, well, let me take that same lens and apply it here and see what was going on. And very often, because I would show up and think, well, I'm Beth. Right. It's like I didn't think about gender. I didn't think about race. I just said, well, I'm Beth. And then I realized, well, it doesn't matter that you're just Beth, because you're still all these other things. And as soon as I would walk into a room, already there would be an opinion formed about me, which is already a bias based on what I look like, and how I present myself. So becoming aware of all that is really important. And I think everybody has bias. That's my belief. I think everybody has implicit bias that you want to surface and make explicit, because you can't address it until you know what it is. So I think once we understand what it is, then we can understand how we can change it. And I think part of it is just naively, we've been educated a certain way. Maybe there was some intentionality in some of the way the educational system is set up, the way we're educated, the what we're reading and not reading. And some of it is just a habit, a pattern, a habit that we have from our childhood that we then give to our children and they give to their children. But we have to like sort of break those patterns. And I think communication, negotiation, implicit bias, all of that, they're all just patterns of behavior and patterns of communication. I hate to harp on this, but going back to the self-awareness, that's when you get to say, is this pattern working for me? Is it working for those around me? Is it helping me build and develop and maintain relationships? And if not, what do I need to do to change that pattern and create a healthier pattern?
Yes, it has a lot to do with the connections in our brain, right? I mean, we've been prefrontal cortex is fighting a more primitive and instinctive parts of our brain, which are super simplistic in terms of how they work. So, which means classification of friend and foes very often takes place based on similarities to us. And it's this never-ending fight between the frontal cortex and the deeper parts of our brain. And I think this is exactly what research shows, is that bias is the extent to which our prefrontal cortex was able to neutralize our more primitive instincts. Let me say it like this, right? And I think it refers not only to gender; it refers to all sorts of mechanisms which we tend to describe as bias, as a deviation from the norm or from a desired pattern of behavior, right? So it is changeable, right? It requires rewiring this part of our brain, but it's not easy. It's not easy because we're fighting our inner,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Which is our inner animals. Let me put it like this, maybe.
Yeah. And I think it's all about, are we safe? Are we safe in this situation? Are we safe physically, mentally, psychologically? And that means any situation. So I'm going to be my better self when I feel safe and comfortable and
right.
I'm on alarm, right? And when I'm not, when I'm feeling not safe, then everything's on alert and I'm going to be very cautious about what I say, what I do, and if I even stay in that environment. And I remember that when I was writing the book, the Me Too movement was becoming very strong. And I thought, I can't not pay attention. I don't want to go into a whole Me Too movement in the book, but I really thought carefully, like, how am I going to include something in here, but not necessarily only address that? So the way I addressed it was helping women think about compromising situations. And so I dealt with it in two different ways. And one way is that if you have to do an assessment, if, trust your gut instincts. If you're feeling something's not right, then think, okay, what's going on here? Why am I not feeling safe? And then you examine that. If you are feeling really threatened, then immediately leave the situation. That's what I say. If you're not quite sure, then you might want to take a break, go outside, have 10 minutes or something, and then reassess what's going on here. If you're still feeling unsafe, physically, emotionally, whatever it is, then you go back and say, I'd like to reschedule, do this a different time, or end the negotiation, whatever it is. But if you feel, let me try it again and see, maybe I was just overreacting to something, then you give yourself another chance in there. And the challenge with women is a lot of, we call about, you know, the old boys network. So if we don't include ourselves in certain networks and conversations, then we're left out of opportunities. If men are going to the cigar bar or they're going to the golf course or they're going to a locker room and they're having conversations, that's where deals get made. You know, in Japan, it was the sake bars after work. Deals get made, arrangements get made there. And if women are not present, they're not there and they're missing out on opportunities. It's this real dilemma. Like, you don't want to put yourself in an unsafe context just to get an opportunity for an advancement, but you also don't want to always not include yourself. And then you're, you know, not being included. So it's just something that you have to reassess all the time. It's unfortunate that we have to do that kind of assessment to see, am I safe? Because, I mean, we should be safe, but we're not always safe. And so it is something to think about, our psychological safety as well as physical.
Great. Wow, that's amazing, Beth. You've mentioned Japan twice already, or three times, and we see nice pictures behind you, and we know that... Exactly. And we know that you spent some time in Japan, a long time in Japan, right? 13 years? Longer, 13 maybe.
13 years, yeah. 13 years.
So if a Japanese woman ever reads New Story, New Power, what do you think would she take out of it? The same, more or less? In other words, it's a disguised version of a question. How culturally dependent are the recommendations in the book?
Self-awareness is self-awareness, right? So that goes cross cultures. So that's okay. And then what happens is, and I remember years ago, I was doing a workshop in an organization, and I remember, you know, talking about how to give feedback and how to express yourself. And then I looked and I thought, okay, it was a very multicultural organization. And I thought, I don't know exactly how the people in the workshop are going to go back to the workplace and say something to their colleagues, to their managers. And if they're from cultures that are not accepting of their comments and the way they're going to say it, then I'm creating a worse scenario for these people. So I had to think about my ethical responsibility. And so it was really about, if you decide to do something about a situation, here are some suggestions that you might want to do. And that's sort of how I wrote the book too. In order to understand yourself, you also have to understand your context and understand the other person that you're interacting with. So you can take the lessons from the book. There's no prescriptive way of what you should say and what you should do. It's really more about how you frame what you should do and what you should say. So you have to understand your own cultural context more than I can. I can't profess to understand the cultural context anywhere in the world except where I am. Right in that moment, because I don't really even know all the cultural context in the US. I haven't been to every state, so I don't know every situation or every country in the world, but I have some general ideas about the way things go. And as long as I know myself and I'm attuned to responses and reactions from others, then I can figure out what to do. So I think every Japanese woman should read the book. Sure, I think they'll get something from it that will apply to them and how they show up in their negotiations for sure.
So it's universal. Certain things, many things are universal. Self-awareness certainly is. It applies just as much to all of us, not only women, also men, right? Regardless of where we are, where we sit, everything else might be. Might be. That's, I guess, the short answer to this question. Yeah. So, Beth, let's have a look behind the scene. I'm super interested in what readers will not be able to read, which means your stories that surprises you, that made you laugh, or maybe made you sad while you were researching or for gathering material for the book. All while you were writing it, anything that you could share with us?
I think one thing that came out is, you know, sometimes people say that even asking a question is an intervention of sorts. So by me asking for women to tell me their stories, to identify the influences in their life that shape how they negotiate, for many women, they hadn't thought about it in the way I asked the question. And so this gave them new insights into themselves, which was fabulous. And they go, wow, I didn't realize that I did that. So some women would follow up with me afterwards and comment on how what they talked about with me, they looked at differently now in their lives and so on. It helped them appreciate different people and influences in their lives that they hadn't necessarily acknowledged beforehand consciously, that this person was such a significant influence. And so I think it helped them see things a little bit differently about themselves. There were many stories that women told that I was just like, I laughed at, because they were talking about the challenges and it's like, wow, these little spitfires, you know, that sort of went and just challenged like this big guy kind of a thing. And also another thing that really impressed me, which I guess is also for me, I'm feeling at the stage of my career too, is the whole idea about giving back and mentorship and nurturing junior women. You know, I mean, I love to advocate for and nurture and help develop younger women in the workplace. I mean, mentor, I'm not, and all genders, I'm not only saying women, but a lot of these women were saying, we want to create pathways for younger women. And so part of what senior women were feeling is what their legacy going to be. You know, they didn't only advance on their own for themselves, but they're realizing that what they did had like lessons learned included that they wanted to share with others and help open up pathways. So for me, having research assistants, having internships, having people assist me in workshops, whatever it is to help people to open up opportunities. Sometimes people contact me for doing workshops and things. And if it's something that I'm just too busy for, I can't do, I bring other people in and I help prepare them and make sure that they're ready. So creating those opportunities for other women to advance, because the reality is there's plenty out there for everybody. I come from a model of plenty and abundance, not scarcity. I don't think that there's a scarcity of stuff in the world. Theoretically, I should be working myself out of a job if I deal with all the women's negotiation stuff or all the conflicts in the world. The reality is, no, unfortunately, they persist. So there's plenty for everybody. And the other reality is that I'm not good for certain scenarios that other women would be better for. So I want them to go there and do things. And so having students and having people who have attended workshops and people I've coached, I live vicariously through what they're doing. And that just makes me feel so much more enriched as well when they come back and tell me, which I always hope they do, come back and tell me what they've done and how it worked out and what they're learning and what they're doing. And I really, really love hearing from them and creating those pathways.
Has the writing process changed the way you negotiate as well?
Well, I definitely say you better prepare, because yes. Well, you know, it's like you can go in and say, well, I wrote the book on it. But then I'm thinking, well, I wrote the book on it. So that means I think I might be held to a higher standard, you know, because people are like, well, you wrote the book. So if I think in that way, then I could become nervous, which I don't want to do. So instead, what I think about, you know what, this looks exciting. This is a great conversation. I want to get to know this person. I want to see who I am in relationship to this person, what I can learn about the person, about me. And so I still try to have that framing of, hey, this looks like an interesting conversation. Let's see where it goes. Even though I know that there are certain negotiation goals and outcomes that I have.
Is there anything that you wanted to include in the book, but you didn't? for one reason or another. I mean, obviously, at some point, probably your publishers wanted to get the manuscript.
Yes. They wanted the manuscript. I tend to write with more brevity, so I did enhance by including some fuller case studies. And now my next project is I'm doing research, and I'm going to have another book where it's going to be a fuller, deeper dive into maybe 6 to 8 scenarios, deeper cases of women negotiating. And it's going to be the heroine's journey where they negotiating, they meet some kind of a challenge and they overcome the challenge and transform in some way. And I don't know exactly what those stories are going to be, but I know enough about what I talked about with other women and still talk about that I'm sure I can gather information to create really interesting stories that I think people can learn from and see themselves in those scenarios. And that even if it doesn't work out the way you want with the outcome you originally set for yourself, it's sort of the commending yourself for the effort. What did you learn in the process and how did you grow from it? So that's my next project. Probably something will come out in ideally 2025.
Ideally 2025. Very much look forward to reading it, to reading those heroine stories of yours, both in terms of inspiration, but also in terms of failures that we can all learn from. Yes, because it's also a part of our negotiation experience. Yeah. Beth, any advice to your younger self or to all young women negotiators out there before they read the book? Is there anything, is there a silver bullet? Is there anything that they could do? One thing that you could share? Hey guys, this is the most important thing I've learned while writing the book or while researching for it. What would you share with them?
That's a lot of pressure on the most important thing. So I'll just say one thing. So for me, growing up, and you know, it's funny because I'll say to people, I think I might have been originally shy, and like, no, you weren't, Beth, so stop that. But you know, I think that every challenge you have to really look at as an opportunity to grow. And so my thinking when I was younger to this day, which I think has served me well, is every time there was a challenge, I would not allow myself to shy away from it, because I had this belief from a young girl that if I didn't do it, if I didn't challenge myself to do whatever it is, some small or large, that challenge would become bigger and harder to do the next time around. So I forced myself to be uncomfortable to grow. And I think that in general, we probably are a lot more capable than we give ourselves credit for, without going overboard and thinking we can do anything. So give yourself the opportunity to try in a reasonable way and learn from the experience and set different kinds of goals. And I do recommend, don't go to the most challenging person about the most challenging topic and try to negotiate. Start small and something that you feel comfortable with somebody discussing, and have a small win and just grow those wins to grow your confidence. And I think then one day you're going to look back and say, wow, I've really done a lot and accomplished a lot, and I've challenged a lot, and I'm glad that I took that first step.
That's an amazing one. But can I pick on one particular aspect of this recommendation, because it's highly interesting to also for me personally? Where do you think this belief comes from? You know, that young girls, you know, instead of walking away, or boys, as young selves, young people have that, you know, not to walk away, not to leave it until tomorrow. Let's just face it. Let's try to solve it. Because I can completely relate to what you've just described. I loved solving these things. At the beginning, it's always a lot of pain because we don't like to invest time or effort or mental capacity into something that is where the reward is postponed until we've solved the thing, right? I mean, so that's the major problem of those challenges, right? We see a solution and then we get the reward, but not today, not tomorrow, but only once we've solved it. And we are not sure whether we are capable of solving it. So some people say, well, let me take it head on, yes, and let me try to, you know, solve it in small steps or larger steps or whatever, whichever way works. But some people say, I don't know whether I'm gonna be able to solve it. So maybe I shouldn't even waste my energy. Where do those beliefs come from? Is it something, you know, that you got from your family, from your environment, or do you believe it's part of your personality, meaning genes?
So I like to say that I was born overconfident and I've been managing it ever since.
I love this answer.
You know, when you think about it, it's like nobody wants to be rejected. But when you think about it, it's what's the worst that could happen? Somebody says no. So if somebody says no, you can take that as a personal rejection, or you can say, okay, they said no now, but maybe I need to ask it in a different way, or maybe the timing wasn't right. Maybe. And you know, the other thing is, I don't know what's happening behind the scenes for that person. There could be, you know, a whole other thing. Like, for example, some people join an organization and then a few months later, their boss leaves and then they're stuck. They don't know that. And maybe the boss knew he was leaving when he hired you, but didn't tell you that. You go into situations expecting it to be a certain way and then it's not. Then what do? You have to stand on your own 2 feet and survive. So that's why I say just do it in increments. You know, don't go to the most challenging, like, tomorrow, I'm not going to say, okay, my goal today is world peace. I mean, I'm not going to be successful, but if I can think about understanding one little part that feeds into that, then that's okay. It's the same thing about, you know, in January when people make New Year's resolutions and try to stick to them. Don't do something like totally unrealistic. Do a, like, you can set the year goal, but do it by month, by week, and do it in increments so that you continue to grow and build and develop your negotiation muscle as you go along. And I think the small wins build confidence. I really do. But if you set an unrealistic goal, you're setting yourself up for failure. And you think, well, what's that about? Why would you do that?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So if the step is too high or too large, well, then divide it into smaller ones.
Yes. Right.
And then cut your way through it, right? Think about what can bring you closer to a solution, to your goal, to achieving your goal. I love this. So basically, what you're saying, what I've understood is slice it. Slices into manageable pieces so that you can gain confidence, you can adjust it to what you believe you can do already, and as you go through the process, every step, every small success will bring you closer to a larger goal. Yeah.
And I think maybe some of that was also some of my training, because my former career, way before all this, was in special education. I work with kids who had learning difficulties. I'm not even sure what the politically correct terminology is now, but they were children who were above normal intelligence, very smart children, but for some reason or other, we're not learning well in a classroom environment. So you have to think, how are we setting up our schools as well? So maybe they had trouble reading, maybe they had trouble writing, but verbally, they could just say whatever they wanted. And then some students would have difficulty following multi-part directions. So you had to break down the tasks. Like if you say to somebody, stand up, turn around, turn left, go down, go, there's too many steps in that. So you say, okay, everybody stand up. They stand up. Okay, now turn to, and then you turn. And then, so you break it down into the steps. And I feel like maybe that has stayed with me as part of my process in what I'm doing, is to break big things down into smaller increments, because then it's easier to be successful at the smaller increments. You know, little children, you're not going to ask them to walk 4 miles, but if they can take a few steps with you, then that's great. And then they build the confidence, and then they do more and they do more. And then suddenly you're realizing, wow, in 1 month, look what they've done, because they go from this to that in a big jump. So maybe that's part of my conditioning too, is breaking things down into smaller steps.
That makes a lot. By the way, when we started, only a few ladies would, let's say, dare to join. Well, I don't know what it is. It's so new. It's a competition. I don't really want it, right? So it would be mostly male dominated. Yes, in the first years. Now I think there are more women participating in our negotiation competitions than men, and they do extremely well. They do extremely well. I think there is. In the past couple of years, as long as I can think about it right now spontaneously, there was at least one woman on the winning teams or in the top three teams. And these teams, and probably that was a, that was a part of their strength, right? Having the diversity of perspectives and making each other stronger, right? So that might be also an interesting message for the ladies out there, meaning, hey, being good at negotiating can also mean being good in a team. Yes, because it's very hard to be good at all possible negotiation contexts and all possible negotiation settings. It might also mean, hey, reflect, yes, become self-aware, think about what you're good at, and let's say emphasize strength or your strengths. And when you feel that you're uncomfortable in a certain situation, then either set a goal and work towards that goal to become stronger, or get someone who's more confident in those contexts where you kind of would dovetail your competencies in that particular field. Yes. So how about negotiating in teams, Beth? How does that fit into the new story and new power?
Yeah, that's a good point there. So I'm thinking about the different roles that we have in teams. So when I'm called into an organization because there's some kind of conflict situation, one of the very common situations is when roles and responsibilities are not clarified. So if people don't know their role and they don't know the responsibilities that go with that role, then there could be either gaps where nobody's filling that responsibility, or there can be redundancies where everybody's sort of running into the same spot together. So if you think about a team, you think about diverse perspectives, teams, when they work well, then they're fabulous, right? The synergy is so much greater than when they don't. So the diversity could tear you apart, or you could learn how to work with the diversity. So that's really important too. So if you're not comfortable being the lead negotiator, it doesn't mean you don't have valuable contributions to how the team prepares what they're doing, because everybody brings different kinds of insights with them. So it's really about creating that space in the team context where each person can rise to his or her strengths in that situation. And then it's great. Then it's very, bless you again, then it's very powerful in that way. So yeah, I think that having diverse teams, you have to also know how to be a team. Because if you don't know how to be a team, then it's going to get in the way of you being effective, I think.
Yes, and this is something we have a privilege of observing during our competitions. Complementary, or setting up a team that consists of complementary skills that don't work against each other, but dovetail and somehow work together towards a common goal, is probably one of the keys in terms of preparation for a high performance context such as a competition or a big stake or a high stake negotiation, right? If we are to negotiate together with someone else, then we need to have the confidence when my skills fall short, somebody else will pick it up and carry me, or let's say will support me at least on our way towards our common goal. All right.
When you're looking at teams for your competition, do you give any tips on what
makes
a team?
Oh, okay. Yes, actually we do. Sometimes teams ask us, hey, are there best practices? Is there something that you could share? And indeed, we've observed that there are at least three, maybe more, critical skills in terms of managing the complexity of a negotiation setting. One is the analysis, which means converting what has been written about the problem or what has been discussed about the problem, what we know about the problem, into the structure of preferences. That's maybe sounds a little bit easier than it really is, right? Yeah. But we need to, as you correctly said, Beth, preparation is super important. What does preparation mean? I mean, it means gathering information and then composing the structure or converting it into the structure of our preferences, and preferably an anticipated structure of the preferences of our partners. So that's analytical skills. Yes, there has to be someone who is the number cruncher, who does not have an issue with converting textual, verbal, or verbal information into numerical or analytical analytical version of it. Empathy, that's number two. There has to be someone whose ears are sensitive enough to be able to do exactly the same from what we are hearing. Yes, meaning as we're asking questions as teams at a negotiating table, someone has to pay attention. What does it mean in terms of the structure of their preferences? Tell me more about it, right? Someone who's responsible for let's say, developing the understanding of what they might potentially need, what might be important to them, more or less important, and so on. So that's number two. Rarely, number one and two rarely go hand in hand. It's extremely difficult to find individuals that that bring both. Okay? And then there is a certain, way of let's say communicating with each other, right? Which establishes rapport, which brings us closer rather than pushing us apart, right? So that's the third skill. The third skill is sometimes compatible with the second, but not always, right? But so these are the three things that we observe that typically the high-performing teams in high-stress, high-stake negotiations bring with them. Yeah? Analysis, empathy, and the ability to communicate, to establish rapport through what we are saying and how we are saying these things. Yeah? So that's at least that would be the three things that comes to my mind.
Interesting. I have to integrate to my negotiation class.
Exactly. So, Beth, my last question, since we are approaching our 60-minute deadline. Great negotiators. So let's focus on women. Let's focus on greatness in negotiation. Is there anyone who has inspired you maybe as you were working on your book or maybe before or after? Anyone who comes to your mind when you think about, hey, I'd like my students to be like him or preferably her?
You know, whenever anybody asks me like my favorite or my best, I'm always like, well, it depends on the situation. I think there have been women over the years who are just remarkable in what they've done. I think, and she wasn't necessarily a negotiator. Maya Angelou comes to mind, just her presence and the way she communicated and influenced people. I think Madeleine Albright was a woman who just had to negotiate a lot of challenging situations in a time when women were still having their voices heard. I think Hillary Clinton is brilliant and has had to deal with many different challenges over the years because of her level of assertiveness and different political beliefs and so on. And somebody who I am going to be writing about is Jacinda Ardern. I mean, what she has done in being Prime Minister of New Zealand and all that. So these are just what come to mind right now. But if I sit down and really look, I'm interested also, like, you know, I see that there are some women in Hollywood who have gone and done different things, like Reese Witherspoon has done different things, even Meryl Streep and so on, Gina Davis. So women who go beyond their fame or their what they're known for and advocate on behalf of others, and they really are role models for a lot of people. So that's just some off the top of my head.
Well, that's an amazing list. And dear ladies, dear women out there who have listened or watched us, if you would like to join this pantheon of great women negotiators, you definitely have to read Beth's recent book, New Story, New Power, A Woman's Guide to Negotiation. I will leave a link underneath in the comments so that you guys can get directly to it. Beth, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, sharing your experience. It's been a great pleasure having you today on our show. I look forward to reading your next book.
I look forward to writing it.
Right, sometime 2025, right?
I'm hoping, yeah.
All right, fingers crossed. Thank you so much, Beth, for
being with us. Thank you, Emmy. This hour just flew by.
It was amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye-bye.